solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
And I was so pleased that His Holiness the Dalai Lama, having read the book, he wrote the foreword. And his foreword is so well put when he says that listening is the first wisdom tool of Buddhism. Now, I never knew that, because we hear about compassion and we hear about reflection and self-knowledge, which he says are the second and the third wisdom tools. But that, as he said, unless you listen, there's nothing new to reflect upon. Unless you listen, you can't understand the other person and feel any compassion. So it's the first necessary discipline.
Welcome to the 34th conversation at the Play to Potential podcast, a series of reflective conversations with leaders across disciplines on topics around leadership, transitions, and careers. I'm Deepak Jayaraman, your host and curator of the podcast. I'm an executive coach and work with leaders during high-stakes transition, whether it's a role transition, leadership transition in a company, or a career transition in an individual's life. I believe that just like businesses need to be coherent about their answers to where to play and how to win, we all need to be thoughtful about our responses to the two questions, where to go and how to grow. This podcast is an attempt at exploring how some leaders across domains have grappled with these two questions as they've gone on their respective journeys. My guest this time is Arun Mehra, former chairman of Boston Consulting Group in India and former member of Planning Commission of India. We spoke at length about his journey in Tata Motors, where he rose to get to the board of the company, but suddenly had to move to the US to take care of his daughter's health situation. He talks about how he transitioned from the world of business leadership, leading a large number of people, to becoming a trusted advisor to leading CEOs and board members. We also spend time exploring the various insights from his book, Listening for Well-being, Conversations with People Not Like Us. We spoke about how, in a post-truth world that's getting noisier and noisier, how it's even more critical for us to listen to different perspectives. We also ended up discussing how listening can be used as a vehicle for giving tough feedback, how it connects to the concepts in Thinking Fast and Slow by Dan Kahneman, The Art of Asking Good Questions, and much, much more. A quick thought on how you could consume the content in the podcast. If you want to listen offline, say during a car ride, plane travel, gym session, or your morning walk, you might want to use one of the popular podcast apps out there. Google and Apple have their podcast players, Spotify, Savan, Stitcher, and several more. If you're keen to get insights by themes across speakers, I would urge you to visit the curated playlist section of the website playtopotential.com. If you want to be informed when I upload new content, you could sign up on the website. You have my word that you will receive less than 2 emails a month, and your data will not be shared with any external organization. Without further ado, over to my conversation with Arun Mehra. Arun, moving on, I wanted to talk about the book Listening for Wellbeing, Conversations with People Not Like Us. Before we get talking about the book, why did you write the book? What was the insight that you wanted to share that was new and different? Because enough has been written about listening. I'm curious about, why you felt the need to write this book and why now?
I became aware that I was not listening deeply to things that I should, and that there was too little listening amongst people by my grandson. And Viren, who lives in the US, my son's son, he now is 13, he was 5 then, and he came visiting us here in Gurgaon. So I took him to show him Delhi and show him India, country of his grandfather and father. And we're driving in the Lodhi Road area, where he was sitting in the back with his mother and my son and I in the front seat. And we stopped at a couple of these traffic lights in Lodhi Road where a lot of these beggars are around. And while I was happily chatting with my son in the front, this little voice piped up at the back and said, Mom, the lady was knocking and no one answered her. So she said, which lady was knocking? He said, there, that when we stopped, the lady was knocking on the window and you didn't answer her. No one answered her. So, you know, there was a knocking there and we even heard, didn't even hear the knock. And no one answered her. So then he carried on. He says, Mom, why do these people have to do everything on the street? So she said, what, Viren? He says, Mom, they are eating on the street. They are cooking on the street. They are sleeping on the street. They are even poo-pooing on the street. Mom, why? So she said, Viren, we are very lucky people. We live in the United States. It's a rich country. We have a house with bedrooms and bathrooms and kitchen. And so we don't need to do things on the street. They have no homes. And so they have to, and they're poor people, you see. And she's asking for money. That's why she's knocking on the window. I heard this conversation and it made me think that, yes, I'm driving in an air-conditioned car, which is the benefits of industrial progress and India's growth. And when I was in India, before we left, that's in late 1980s, there were ambassadors and Fiats, and we drove around, and there were beggars then too, but they weren't air-conditioned, these cars, and the beggars would put their hands inside the windows because the windows had to be down, it was hot, and you had to push them, chodo, or put something in their hand, and you were in touch with people. We were now out of touch, and this thought about the knocking on the window, the sound, that are we really aware of the lives of people? Are we listening to their stories? Are we listening to their lives? So that metaphor sort of came into mind.
Fascinating. Thank you so much for your time. Excited to be talking to you.
My pleasure. Thank you for coming.
Indeed. Maybe a good place to start, Arun, is trying to get a sense of how you spend time today. Give us a sense of what your pie chart of time looks like today. What do you do, and more importantly, why do you do what you do?
Some of the best part of my time these days is people who come to meet me. They've got a venture in mind, or they're on to a journey to do something which is very important to them and difficult. And they come and talk with me about what they're doing and how they're succeeding and the challenges that they are having. All the people that I meet nowadays by choice are people who are not building corporations. I mean, I've done many years of myself building corporations and consulting to leaders in big corporations. Now it's into a more challenging world, a more aspirational world of people who want to make a difference to the lives of many others around them. And it's not providing them products and services which they will pay for. It is helping those people to earn more, to produce products and services in turn, which will enable them to earn more, as well as, you know, improve the health of people, education of people, and so. So I spend my time with wonderful people doing wonderful things, and we get into very learningful discussions for me, and I hope for them too, on how one could make a difference in such a world, in an open system in which one wishes to produce change, but one is not the leader of a large organization with the resources and the visibility, and therefore the attraction of others to one, that makes it easier actually to make change.
And I'm curious, given this sort of a method of spending time, if I may, what do you say no to and what do you say yes to? I'm sure there are a lot of people that are seeking, placing demands on your time. So what's the prioritization mechanism as you think about what you say yes to and no to?
Well, I also spend a fair amount of my time reading and writing. And these three means time with real people doing real things, as well as reading a lot about the world and how change could be brought about in the world, and such people and other stories enables me to make selections that I know I could get a lot of learning from things in books and so on. So if the person is just like one of those and quoting all those things to me, I would be interested. But if someone else is, you know, talking from his or her own life and is a very well-informed person, I can see, and has read as much as the person on his own or her could do, and is coming to me after that. So I find that there are people who come to me just to get education, as they say, you know, tell me how to do the obvious things to me. Then I find that in a way a waste of my time. You know, please go do your own homework, or get into life and do it for 3 or 4 years. Then you get to the real questions. Then I can be, I think, a more useful coach to these people. Otherwise, I mean, go Google, go read some things, and you'll know what you're trying to take my time for.
Got it. Got it. Well, thank you. Thank you for making the time, given what you just said. And maybe before we dive into listening, I wanted to start about trying to understand the art of asking good questions. You know, you've been a consultant at Arthur D. Little, BCG, and even in the various things you've done. Again, in your experience, what have you learned about framing the question right in eliciting, you know, thoughtful responses or navigating a certain discussion in a meaningful way?
Yeah, you know, there's this, the what and how and the why, different ladders that people describe, or the three whys, in terms of inquiry. And I say, okay, we look at data, and so there is a lot of questions about the data. Where's the data? How does the data add up? So you go down that path about the data and trying to see reality through reorganizing and adding up or subtracting in the data itself. And you can go down that path also into the logic behind in the data itself.
Right.
Yeah, so this weight will lead to that. So we come to the next level of maths, which is not just addition and subtractions, but you go to more, you know, calculus maths. And so there's a whole way of thinking about how to make sense of the data. And I say, fine. Now the data is being interpreted by a mind. The data also is collected by people who felt that that was good data to get. So there was a mind which chose what data to select. So there are minds here. So there's a reasoning in the mind about why this is important data. So I learned to switch myself off the deductive track pretty quickly and to ask, why do you think one should be looking at this data? And then I would notice quite often that the why that person thinks this data is important is the reason, probably ask the question, because I think it's, what's the point of this data? I don't think this data is important, but this person is, you know, presenting all this stuff. Why do you think it's important? So I'm learning about another person's way of thinking and what another person gives value to, which apparently is not what I give value to, and it's not my way of thinking. Right. So this is how I'm, people not like us, as I say, I'm listening to someone who's not like me. Now, in this situation, both of us could be, let's say, in BCG or in the world of business and BCG, there are people like us.
Right.
So we have a way of thinking and things we value and the data that we consider important, which is similar. And then you come to people who we consider, you know, ill-educated, right? Or people who are rabid in their thinking. They're not like us.
Right.
But they are human beings, and they, many of them got their PhDs, if you want to count that as also that they have education, or they've been through life very successfully in some field. So, but they value different things and they think about the world in a different way. So then I have to ask them about more questions about how they came to believe that these things are important. So learning about them, their journey, how they developed their values and their mental frames. And so that's how then I'm learning at even deeper levels about even the formation of my own values. I mean, how did my values form?
It's not just looking at the data, but really sort of going two levels down on how they look at the data and why they look at the data.
Yes, yes, and what they value.
Fascinating. And in the book, I really like the metaphor where you say listening is a bit like yoga, where you breathe out the desire to direct the conversation so that you're able to breathe in the point of view of the other. But again, as a leader, sometimes you need to steer a ship in a certain direction. There are objectives to be met and stakeholders to be satisfied. How do you balance the need to steer conversation somewhere as a leader with the point you make about resisting the urge to steer? Is there a tension there?
There is, of course, there is. But I reconcile it like this, that you know, if I care deeply about something, very deeply, and I want that to be the driver of not just myself, but of the world, some value that I care about very deeply, I can't run away from that. To change that is very difficult and perhaps not necessary. I mean, if my value is one in which I want to make the world better, and in my perspective, better for other people and not just myself, then I should pursue that value. But I want followers to come along with me. People will follow if they care for where you're going, if they care for the same thing that you care about. I would hate to be in a position where I've marched off with this great passion and commitment, thinking in my mind that this is the right thing and people will follow me. And then I turn around, you know, having marched off anything, I find no one's behind me. Then I'm like Don Quixote on his little animal, you know. No one's around. And I can pretend I'm a leader, but there are no followers. So I must, as I take off on this journey, start listening to others around myself, listening to what they care about. You see? And if I want to influence them with my caring, as I learned in my days in Tartars, when you are listening to someone else, there's a window given to you because they will ask you also. Then only they will honestly, openly ask you after you have respected them and heard them. Then they might. Otherwise, they may, because you're the boss, hear you, but they're not wishing to follow you. They don't wish to follow you. They may have to. So I do feel that for a leader, yes, you must have something that you care about. So I say that my definition of leadership is she or he who takes the first steps towards something that she or he deeply cares about and in ways that others will wish to follow. So in that sentence with these three parts, I think there's some key things here. It's about something that you deeply care about. It's about taking the first steps and not waiting for others to take the steps. So you take the risk. And immediately, in ways that others wish to follow. And to locate what others' wishes are. And to maybe even be molded by their wishes. It's okay. Be open to change yourself.
Very, very interesting.
This is your host Deepak Jayaraman here. Just a quick comment here. Listening when you're in a new context is often counterintuitive to a lot of people that are keen to assert their power and influence by taking charge and by showing who's the boss. But if you're looking to drive change over the long term, listening to build trust and to develop a nuanced picture of what's going on is critical before you come up with your theory of change that will take the organization forward. Ravi Venkatesan, one of my earlier guests, spoke about this when he spoke about his appointment as the chairman of the board at Bank of Baroda.
What you have to do is listen intently. And I did. I made it a very conscious effort to listen to a bunch of people, retired chairman of the Bank of Baroda. Okay, so help me understand from your perspective, you know, what I should do, what the issues are, how would you handle them? You get a certain perspective. I went and spoke to Vagul of ICICI and PJ Nayak of Axis Bank.
Sure.
Even though they've been around and seen the evolution of the banking sector. I've met a lot of our own employees and so forth. So from this, you begin to piece together first the situation, and then out of that emerges a theory of change, which is, you know, what interventions are really going to make a difference and who are going to be the important allies in this. If you don't listen and you come in with a point of view, you start you know, jumping into action right away, you're going to make a lot of mistakes because you haven't built this nuanced and reasonably accurate picture of the landscape.
Ensuring that we listen to a range of voices and form a nuanced picture before we move forward is critical, especially when we move to a new context. Now, let's get back to the conversation with Arun Mayra.
And the other angle or the other perspective you bring into listening is even during tough feedback conversations. You mentioned in the book that instead of giving the feedback, you listen. What's the insight there? Expand on that. Because I think everyone has to have those moments where you need to have that difficult conversation and you need to have that give that tough feedback. And this piece of insight would really be of value of how do you really listen your way through a tough feedback conversation that you need to give.
You know, there's a very lovely saying that if a big tree falls in the forest and there's no one there to hear, was there a sound? So the listening is completed in the ear and the mind of the listener. Okay? So you have to prepare that ground to want to listen, to hear. So you're speaking very accurately with the best of intentions that I mean in the best interest of this person. But that window there has not been opened. And there are many reasons that window may not be opened. One of them could be just in the relationship that this person, it comes in a different world from a different world. So I will discount whatever this person says. Though the person's saying it with the best of intention, it's my feeling of difference from this person. The second comes is what this person thinks there's something wrong with me and therefore is giving me advice. Then I'm putting on my defenses anyway. There's nothing wrong with me. How dare this person think so? So to get beyond these sort of barriers that we all put up for our own protection so that we are not, you know, kicked around, I just have to allow myself to listen to this person. When I'm listening to the person, those barriers inside the person are being dropped. The person dropping defenses. The person is enjoying listening to herself, actually, because you're making the person talk. And a person is listening to herself when you ask the questions about what the person thinks. Because the person himself or herself may never have thought about why I think this way. They say, you know why I think this way? Now you're listening to your own mind. So I'm helping a person to listen to their own mind. And what I find very difficult, but I enjoy doing, is when I'm making someone else listen to their mind, I listen to why I asked that question. There must be something in me that prompted me to think that this was a good question to ask. Something in my thinking, which felt that was sort of a foreign situation. So I asked this question. But I'm asking it in a curious way. I'm not asking it, I try my best not in a diminishing way for the other person. But so I'm learning about myself too. So this is what I put out in the book. And I was so pleased that His Holiness the Dalai Lama, having read the book, he wrote the foreword. And his foreword is so well put when he says that listening is the first wisdom tool of Buddhism. Now, I never knew that because we hear about compassion and we hear about reflection and self-knowledge, which he says are the second and the third wisdom tools. But that, as he said, unless you listen, there's nothing new to reflect upon. Unless you listen, you can't understand the other person and feel any compassion. So it's the first necessary discipline. So I link that to, you asked me about yoga, that you know, listening sounds something so simple. I mean, how could just by listening, the world becomes a better place, you're saying, I become a better person. It's such a simple thing. And talking of complications of people, you know, killing each other on the streets and lynching each other and on social media, demolishing each other. I mean, the world isn't a bad place. How by just something like listening, could the world progressively become better? And I say, well, yoga is what is just breathing. It's such a simple thing. You're born to breathe. A child breathes. And then you're telling us, please breathe better, more effectively. Your whole body will be toned up. Your mind will feel better. Your heart is better. Your lungs are better. Your digestion is better. Very complicated systems. By simple act of breathing, which yes, we are born to do but don't do well. And similarly, I'm saying listening, a child is a curious thing. Child is born to, you know, say, strange sound, what is it all about? And we start teaching the child to put filters on. Okay, this is bad things, don't listen to that person, don't talk to, they got the wrong ideas. And you know, children do go and they're curious, they say, nah, it's bad for you. So look how we create the filters, the lenses in minds of children and ourselves, which shut out all that is different to us.
Fascinating. The other piece I really found interesting was in the book you talk about a 2x2, where you talk about richness on one scale and reach on the other. And clearly there's a trade-off there. You can have deep conversations with few people, but as you increase the number of people somewhere, the depth gets compromised. And it's probably even more pronounced given the proliferation of social media and a lot of the low-touch conversations we end up having. What are your insights around having deep conversations at scale, if I may use the term?
Yeah. Well, you know, I love what we are doing, the two of us sitting on a chair facing each other. And there's a very gentle person, of course, recording our conversations with three chairs. I mentioned in the book what Henry David Thoreau,
right.
And he said, you know, I built this little cabin and I've got two chairs for having a conversation and a third chair in case it's for society. So there's a third chair there. Beyond that, he says, you know, there's just too many people.
Right.
And that's true. I can look you in the eye and I can see that you're listening to me so well. So, you know, I'm interested also in you. So we're having a deep dialogue here, I think, amongst ourselves. But as you start getting to 10 people into the room, into the same so-called conversation, each feels a need to speak, has the need to speak. Then what others say start influencing what one person is saying. And so you get into a conversation which is no longer able to explore any one person's point of view in any depth. So the larger you go in the conversation, you're reaching more people, but the richness of the conversation diminishes. Now, this is like a physics fact anyway, and the social media is suffering from this.
Right.
That if you make a lot of information available to people, they can't concentrate on everything at the same time. So they have to make choices. And if they wish to remain connected with many things, which is the beauty of being on social media, they will have to perforce shallowly connect with many things.
Right.
They can't go too deep into too many things, otherwise they can't keep attention to so many things. So we have to make a choice between richness and reach. However, my intellectual and practical challenge is this, that in the vast conversations, or the large numbers of conversation happening, can't we introduce more richness than there is presently? So I talk about the ways of masked dialogue. So I say, even if in a 10-minute conversation that I have with some person, I could get to insights about myself and the other person that usually, even in a one-hour conversation, I don't get, then I've got sort of efficiency introduced into a one-on-one conversation. Similarly, if I could say a meeting of 10 persons, if conducted differently, could enable those 10 persons to find something deeper about the system in which they are all together, as well as about themselves, than they do in a usual about the data conversation. So you see, we talked about data earlier. Many of our conversations are, let's keep to the data and let's keep opinion out of this place. We say that, you know, there's no time here to discuss your opinions, get the data out. So we force people to, in fact, not delve into the more important, interesting things that we should be delving into for our own sakes and for the sake of the collective. We just stick at that data level and we're not learning more. Economics is having this problem because, you know, needs large masses of data so that it can prove that this phenomenon applies everywhere. So you use large amounts of data and the data doesn't represent accurately anything anywhere anymore.
And back to maybe getting a little tactical here, Arun, getting deeper in a 10-minute one-on-one conversation and let's say deeper in a 10-person conversation that you're facilitating, what are some of the tactical, let's say, insights you want to share with the listeners? For example, what do you do differently now in a 10-minute one-on-one that you didn't maybe 20 years back?
You know, I find in my daughter does this in the California. She's a master at this very well. And my wife observes this about me now. So we get into a train, or we just, you know, some doorman at a place with us for 3 minutes because the car hasn't come. And she says, your instinct is always to ask the person, so nice to see you, this is a nice place, are you happy here? And then the person will say, yeah or nay. Then I ask the person, so what were you doing before this? Of course, if the person says he's happy here, I promptly do ask, so what makes you so happy here? If the person, which is very rarely, they would say, but they do say sometimes that, you know, it's not quite nice here. Then I ask, so what's not quite nice here? And within 3 or 4 minutes, that person had a conversation with me, as they say to me, that they hardly have with anyone else. And I have learned something about a human being. And the next time I meet that person, I see that we can carry on from there if I want to. Or the person, in any case, treats me differently. But I seem interested in the person.
Fascinating. And maybe just to complete the point, Arun, leaders today go to a lot of meetings, right? Facilitate a lot of meetings. What have you learned about facilitating a productive meeting? Again, when you were part of the planning commission, you had to facilitate meetings often between stakeholders with agendas that pulled in different directions. What have you learned about the art of facilitation, especially when you've got sort of diverse voices in the room?
Yes, well, you know, there are meetings and meetings and meetings, and there are discussions and discussions and discussions. To design a good meeting, one must establish first what's the purpose of the meeting. And that's how you start the design of anything, you know, sure. What's the purpose of it. So what's the purpose of this meeting? So there can be a meeting which is merely to present some information to everybody. You call it a meeting, fine. Right. But that's the purpose, then let's do that efficiently and effectively. There can be a meeting where many people need to provide information. So I can design a meeting where that is happening efficiently. Then there can be meetings where you say, we want to start locating what is really going on here. Going on here means in the system in which we are.
Right.
Now, if they say that's the purpose of the meeting, then I would ask them first that, look, is there enough information already available amongst you about what is going on in this situation? If not, then you'll have to have a longer meeting, because in the first part, at least this data level, so that we have common data, is out there. After that, we go into another meeting, as you will. It's the same group, maybe, in the second stage. We are going to now explore what we believe is right or wrong in what is going on out there. And then deeper than that, what we believe is causing this to happen. So this is, you know, our theories of why certain things are happening. And quite often, of course, that ends up in logical differences as well as ideological differences.
Right. And you also talk about discussion, debate, deliberation, and dialogue. And you talk about the specific differences between these. Again, for the purpose of our understanding, what's the crux of the insight here? Because people often use these terms loosely.
Yes, yes.
So in your mind,
Yes. Well, I'll say very broadly, you know, so the four D's. In a discussion, I say it's just like it doesn't matter. You're not bothering about whether there's a purpose here to it at all. In a debate, you are wanting to debate between... It's a good debate. The word implies that between two points of view. And this is the old Socrates and the Greek method that, you know, set a dialectic up between this and that. And this has been the form of a discovery about the rightness in any matter that has gone into the court systems, you know, the prosecutor and the defendant and debates. And it's a way of inquiry. This way of inquiry, of course, makes you defend a point of view and want to win against another. So you're setting up a sort of a boundary and a competition between two points of view. When you go into a deliberation, it's not a contest. There are different points of view and perhaps even conflicting points of view, but you're not wishing to break it up into, well, who won and who lost. And therefore, in a deliberation, I would not set it up against, well, this versus that. Whereas I do find, whether it's on TV or in college, it had to be that, are you for or are you against?
There's no gray zone. Yeah.
There's no gray zone. In a deliberation, there are many gray things happening there, and so we are exploring them all. But in the deliberation, we would stay in the ladder of meetings I was talking about at that second level where we got the data, like, and we are exploring what is going on. What is going on? In a dialogue, I wish to come to a deeper understanding about why you think that way and who you are. So the dialogue is always used, as you know, in that thing where two people generally, therefore they say, are in dialogue. They're four eyes conversations, as the Germans say, two eyes looking into two other eyes and trying to understand each other.
Just picking up another question, Arun, leaders, I'm a big fan of the work of a professor in Harvard called Joseph Badaracco, and he uses the term right versus right, which leaders often have to grapple with when they make tough decisions. A couple of questions here. One is, what have you learned about the art of judgment, which is making good decisions when, you know, you've got multiple forces pulling in different directions? What have you seen good leaders do, and what's been your experiences in developing a sense of refined judgment, number one? And number two, how do you drive through the implementation? In any of these situations, typically when you make a decision, there are a few people that are positively impacted, there are a few people that are negatively impacted. How do you carry the entire ecosystem with you?
This comes to a deep matter of values, and this is going on through human history between the utilitarian school and, if I will, the individual human rights liberty school. The utilitarian school says that if an action produces the maximum good for the maximum number of people, even if some few people are going to lose, it's a good decision. Yeah. Whereas the liberty school, the human rights school, says even if one person suffers, and it may produce benefit for lots of others, it is not the right decision. So this is a matter of very deep values. So I'm saying here that both seem right. I mean, to you and me in this day and age, the latter view about individual human rights seems as valuable a view as would be the utilitarian view. Possibly 100 years ago, the individual human rights view wasn't so weighty. It was in individuals. That's why Jesus came up, because in our Buddha also the suffering of one person. But it was the more universal thing was, you know, good leaders like Chanakya said, you know, you just make sure the whole population is looked after. That's been the general thing about leaders of large systems, you know, just make the whole system work. And if you have to sacrifice some fellows and fire them from the company for the sake of the continuity of the employment of the rest, and so be it. So I'm saying there's something very fundamental here, which can't be reconciled. However, I go forth and say that situations are different also.
Sure.
So maybe in some situation, and considering the nature of the decision to be taken, I could take a utilitarian view. But there are other situations where I cannot and should not take the utilitarian view. So what are these matters, though? And so people would say, like, the right to education. And so long as the majority of people are being educated, if some few are not being well educated, who cares? I mean, the average education in the country is fine. The country is going to progress. And others would say, well, no, even if a few children are left behind, it's a very bad system and you can't allow this to happen. Now, that's a borderline sort of thing. Now, I reflect on it and I say that if I do believe that every child must have an equal right to the things which will give them a chance thereafter in life to stand on their own feet, then, like, every child has the need for an equal education. And I don't care if the richer's education suffers for the sake of providing an equal education to those deprived. Right. Even though if I multiplied and said, so many rich multiplied by the high quality is so big, so many poor by little less quality overall, so I said, no.
It's not a mathematical problem.
It's not a mathematical problem.
Got it. In the book, you also talk about the parallel with Dan Kahneman, and you talk about thinking slow and thinking fast, and you sort of compare that to listening. Talk to us a little bit about, you know, how that plays out and how we listen, and what's the lesson for us to be thoughtful listeners.
Yes. You know, as Dan Kahneman says, there's a thinking fast part of the mind, and then there's a thinking slow part of the mind, which processes for reflection and thinking slow. The thinking fast part of the mind exists in all beings, animals, birds, and so. It is the part which enables you to take signals about from the environment and make quick judgments about whether there's danger or like food opportunity. And you must move fast, otherwise either you'll be killed or you lose the opportunity. So that's the thinking fast part. What human beings have more of than other animals is the thinking slow part, where you take data and the data gets stored and chewed upon like a cow chewing the cud. And so you try to make sense of it and form a pattern out of it and get insights out of it. And so, and called thinking slow, like you said, it takes time. You must allow it to reflect. What is being observed with the social media is that because of the nature of the technology, which is giving you things in very short bursts and offering you many things, you have to make choices. Should I take that lead, that hyperlink? I'm being tempted to buy and buy now and click into Amazon and so. So the thinking fast part of minds is being used much more. And any muscle that you use more, any part of your body use more, grows stronger. And here's the trade-off, unfortunately, that because your time then is being used and your mind and the thinking fast and the overall capacity is one, the thinking slow part is not being used as much and is atrophying. And tests on the sizes of shapes of brains of young kids in the US have shown that they can already observe this shift. The earlier shift, which is the one to do with the empathy part, which is also the back part. The front part is danger, no danger, and you know, don't judge about who the person is and feeling empathy for the person. That in college students in the United States, in 10 years' time, this is after social media has come, they've observed a 40 to 50% decline in the empathy of college students to each other by standard psychological tests. Again, they're attributing it to they're not spending any time, deep time, with each other. It's just short, shallow connections with lots of people. So you're getting the benefit of reach, if you will, and losing that richness. And this is now the richness of your own minds and your own beings. So that's one side. The other is these moral judgments that you were talking about. There's a very large part of us which is built up through our histories and our conditionings and so which makes us value things which are like feeling loyal to family, feeling loyal to the community, feeling proud of my identity, respecting authority that enables us to survive as a family, as a community, you know, father. And so this is built in for the sake of maybe my survival and our goodness. This doesn't sound rational to those who believe in, let's say, philosophy through calculations. But these things are so instinctual. They're sort of grown and they're conditioned by society also. So when you do like a Greek philosopher or like a Shankaracharya, that you by reason you can discover what's the right thing to do. I'm afraid the large part of us tells us the right thing to do without our reasoning. It's just built into our system. In fact, they're finding that the genes also, some parts of the genes have some of these desires to you know, support others like yourselves. That's why the selfish gene. And so, so it's a much deeper thing than that. So I do think we need to start understanding ourselves more fully.
What are some of the tactical changes you've made to your life to ensure that you keep that thinking slow part humming, if you will?
Reading is a wonderful thing, especially if it's a tough book. It makes you stop and reflect and think about, you know, why do I disagree with this? And is this person going to explain it or not? And if not, let me go find someone else who's going to explain. So it makes me think very slow and makes me reflect.
A different question altogether. In a world where the noise levels are going up and up, there's a need for people to be louder and louder to be heard. And again, if I may go back to the first thing you said, which is individuals trying to make a difference, not large corporations, but smallish organisms, if you will. How do you get your voice heard in a world that's getting noisier? Listening again, is there a, what's the tension again with using listening as a way of
you struck my present dilemma. I don't know what's a dilemma. Then I say, why do I want to be heard? You know, if I'm feeling concerned that I'm not being heard, I ask myself, why do I want to be heard? What is so great about what I am saying or thinking that I insist that or desire that others hear it? It's why? Why? So that's where I am at now.
That's an interesting perspective. And if it's, I guess, just maybe taking it forward, if it's worthy of being listened to, I guess the followership will follow instead of you being louder, maybe.
Yeah, no, but there's a practical thing. I don't know whether you experience it, and you perhaps do too in the work that you do, because you're a profound listener, I can see. But, you know, you want maybe this conversation to be heard by others. But then you'll have to do something to get your this conversation noticed, your product noticed, what you do noticed.
Right.
And if you have to be noticed, you'll have to be more noticeable than other people.
Right.
Yeah, so what they do, the yelling that they do, the wrong facts that they put out to get attention to themselves, you'll have to do some of that, otherwise you won't be noticed. So are you willing to do that? And some people would say, going back to the question you asked, that if I have to make a difference to the world, I'll have to do some of those things.
That's what
they're necessary things to do, not that I like doing them. And this is where therefore comes to the political question to say, well, I need to get elected so that I can change the world. And to get elected, I would have to do many things which I'm going to eliminate after I get elected. There'll be no corruption after that and so on. Or, you know, I'll be a dictator, but after that, there'll be democracy. It doesn't happen because you change meanwhile. You change. As Acton said, you know, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So once you are so strong that you could do it very easily, you're no longer a person who wants to do it. And so you become something else in the process. So anyway, we need to be more effective. You, I hope, will be more effective at getting others to hear the very lovely conversations that I've listened to, the conversations that you've had with other people. Is profound. And
thank you.
And I want to thank you for including me in your list of
thank you,
persons you talked to.
Pleasure is completely mine. And maybe just a couple of questions to wrap up. I'm also curious about, you know, people's operating system, not just what they do, but what's the operating system under them. If you had to be immodest about yourself and really look at your journey, again, back to meditation, look at it from a distance. What about you has enabled you to come this far? What are some of the principles with which you've led your life, which you think has played a role in this journey that you've had?
You know, we've been talking and you've been asking me about the principles in my life, but you're now relating it to like a success and come this far. And I, at this stage in life, I'm honestly feeling... I think I'm right. I'm honestly feeling that it's not important. I mean, whatever I have, others may say I've achieved, it's not important. So therefore, trying to relate what I do to this thing as a success is not a thing that I've applied myself or wish to apply myself to too much. Mm-hmm. But I don't want to do something for the sake of having success. So it goes back to this Bhagavad Gita's thing which I started reading the Bhagavad Gita when my mother gave it to me when I was 15 or 16 years old. And I come to chapter 2 and that para which says, you know, you have the right to the work and not to the fruits thereof. And believe me, as I am now 75, I just can't get beyond that chapter, that verse. You only have a right to the work and not to the fruits thereof. And I think it speaks to the question you asked me. I'm doing what I believe is a good thing to do, not because it's producing a good result. So when you talk of success, it's like a good result.
Fair point. And again, maybe just using the lens of hindsight, if you had to meet your 20-year self, a 40-year self, and a 60-year self, what's that one piece of advice you would give to these individuals?
I think my 20-year self, I find I can't give too much advice to. The 20-year self was in a very innocent way, with a more innocent view of the world, thinking like I'm thinking now. Mm-hmm. my 40-year self had got a bit spoiled by success achieved rather soon. So my 40-year self was struggling with these questions of staying on a track which was giving me success. And what would happen if I stepped out of that track? Would I be noticed? Would I be successful? So it's success, therefore, you know, causes that change in you, which I, as reflecting in hindsight, I have not just today, but before thought about it, that that was the struggle going on in me in my early 40s, when, of course, it was, choice was thrust on me, fortunately, because of family circumstances, that I just had to do something which had to start me all over again.
Sure.
All over again, discovering who I was, what I wished to do, what I could do even better. And so it was a good reset.
And your 60-year self?
And my 60-year self? Yeah, the 60-year self, I same. But the 40-year self had confronted the choice and gone into the old track again. Then once again, one has a, you know, journey up to success. And by the time of 60, again, one is being recognized and celebrated. So I could again sense the same thing, you know, am I giving it up needlessly, and why not? Others are keep saying to you at that age, you're young enough, you're healthy enough, you know, we need you still. And that plays to your ego. But I found it easier, I must say. I found it easier when I was 60 than I did when I was 40, because I think you've reflected on these questions for 20 years in between.
Got it. Just in summary, Arun, this podcast is titled Play to Potential. And it sort of speaks to two themes. One is about picking a playground where you can flourish and then doing and playing the best game you can. In summary, what do you want to leave the listeners with for them to play to the unique potential?
I hope that every person sooner rather than later in life would feel that they would like to live their life even better in a way that will make life better for everyone. So it's a sort of feeling of compassion for the world around. And in that world better for everyone, of course, the physical environment is a part of it too. It's the whole system around oneself. And of course, people keep saying, leave the world in a better shape than when you came into the world. So maybe that's one way to put it. Another, of course, people say, what sort of world are you leaving for your grandchildren? And I ask young children today that, look, yes, to ask me what sort of world I want to leave to my grandchildren, they are 13 years old, and maybe they should be asking themselves the question about what sort of world do they want to live in? So I am asking myself, and I ask, this is what I put out as a question to young people, whatever age they are, so they're in the 40s or they're in the 20s. What sort of world do you want to live in? What sort of world do you want to live in? I find if when there are some 50 people or even 300 people together in a room, and the broad subject is, you know, how to make the world better, or how they could be better leaders in their own lives, I always start with the question to them that, what do you care about most in life? And I say, just think about it, and don't look at me, and allow yourself to concentrate on your own thought. And so, and if you feel like noting it down for your future reference, please do so. So after 5 minutes, I find that they also must in their minds, or some writing some things down, I say, I'm going to give you 2 more minutes, and then please, let's continue. And after those 2 more minutes, I mean, some have stopped, but some have to be stopped and say so. And they say that, you know, this is something we never reflect on. We're so busy doing, as they said in the recent meeting I was, like the Spanish team, you know, passing balls very efficiently
tiki-taka
to each other, tiki-taka, that we forget there's a goal. What's the goal of my life? You know, what do I care about most to achieve in life? So after that, I do suggest to them that if you could, let's take 10 more minutes out of this longer discussion that we are going to have, and ask someone next to you what they care most about in life. I mean, they've thought about it now, but listen to them. don't start saying, why do you think about it? It's the first time I've heard it. It's unusual. Just calmly listen. Look in the eye, appreciate this person's caring, and then the person will hear you. Now that also, they want to hear a third person, and so I said, okay, we've got the ground prepared. So in this, with this Kaplan, we go on later in to what one has to do, at the end of which I say about the first steps you're going to take towards creating a world which is going to have this quality of the caring that you care about in the world. So what is it you are going to do now? Now, whether you're 20 years old or you're 60 years old or whatever, what is it you're going to do now to take you and the little world around you, which you could influence, on that path? So it's getting that definition of leadership into action. Take the first steps towards that which you deeply care about and in ways that others wish to follow. And that's where the reminder to them to listen to the caring of others who could be in a partnership with them.
Pleasure, Arun. Really, really inspiring talking to you. Thanks so much for making the time.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
Hope you found this conversation purposeful. I do think listening to others' perspectives is one of the superpowers that we all need to have to make meaningful progress as individuals and as a society in the coming years. More specifically, three things really resonated with me in this conversation. First is the point Arun makes about asking better questions. When I'm working with a leader in transition who comes to me saying, what should I do next with my life? I realize that it's imperative for me to understand their world the way they see it. How do they prioritize work, family, me time and community? What does success and impact mean to them? What energizes them? And how their journeys have shaped their views on some of these questions. Only then do I feel ready to be of help to them in helping them navigate their ship effectively. Even if I go back to my days as a search consultant at Egon Zehnder, while discussing with candidates, I would often get a lot more insight about a person by trying to understand why they did what they did at various points in time, rather than just focusing on what their stints have been and what they've accomplished in each of these stints. The second thing that struck me in this conversation was the link Arun makes between listening and the thinking slow part of the brain, referring to Dan Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow. I guess it's critical for each one of us to create the space or silence or the cabin in the woods, so to speak, we could escape to, for us to reflect on things, mull over ideas, and let things marinate for a while. I'm reminded of the work by Adam Grant in his book Originals. One of my takeaways from the book was that for path-breaking creative thought to happen, if you plot the quality of the thought in the y-axis and the elapsed time on the x-axis, it often looks like an inverted U-curve. He says that if you take too much time and procrastinate, the market might have moved on by the time you come up with your innovation. But he also says that there's something to be said about being too early. If you haven't considered things enough, listened adequately to multiple perspectives, and let the idea marinate in your head for a while. By doing it too quickly, you're missing out on benefiting from the thinking slow part of the brain, where you're being deliberate and thoughtful about things. I guess what reading does that other forms of media don't do enough of is it gives you the ability to pause, reflect, think, ponder, and come back and deal with the content at your pace rather than it being thrown at you. I guess the key is also to ask ourselves, are we listening to ourselves enough as we go through our journeys? The third thing that struck me was that we all have a role to play in how we frame a conversation or an interaction, whether we set it up as a discussion, deliberation, dialogue, or a debate. The structure of the conversation needs to be informed by the objectives. Every so often, meetings in a company are organized without adequate thought to who should attend, how would it be facilitated, what's a good outcome, and so on. The related thought here is that we possibly need much more deliberation and much less debate. We need to be spending much more time exploring each other's point of view and build a more nuanced understanding of the situation, and less on debates where we're trying to win the argument at all costs. As a leader, how we frame the conversation and facilitate the interaction can play a significant difference in the outcomes and, more importantly, the culture of the organization. Thank you for listening. I look forward to having you at one of the subsequent conversations at the Play to Potential podcast. The next guest is Ambi Parameswaran, one of the leaders in the ad agency world. He talks about his book Sponge, where he discusses the learnings he's had working with CEOs ranging across Ratan Tata, Mr. Varghese Kurian, Mr. Karsan Bhai Patel, and so on.
So you have to pick the right things, you know. When I joined Ulka, I remember the head of Lintas at that time, Alec Padamsi, said, "You're making a big mistake. This agency will shut down." I said, "Okay, if it shuts down, then I'll come to you for a job." So he said, "Yeah, okay, good answer. But, you know, you should join us now." I said, "No."
And how did you pick Ulka out of the other options?
Former boss joined Ulka. Okay. And I wanted to go to Chennai, to work in Chennai for 5 years or whatever. So he said, "Okay, place yourself wherever, look after whatever, you come." So I went. The company was, actually, I don't know how he hired me, because the company was not making too much money, making a loss. But he was assembling a team of like-minded people. And then the thing worked. So I think whichever job you're in, whether in advertising, marketing, I think the first probably 10 years is when you need to figure out what gets you going.
Hmm.
And then by the time you're probably 35, you should hit the highway.
You commit to a direction.
Yeah. Hmm. And then stay on that for the next 15, 20 years. And then decide whether you want to work till 60 like I did, or want to get off at 55, or you want to work till 70. That's up to you.
If you're a marketer or a professional providing advisory services to CEOs and board members, you might find some of these insights relevant. For that matter, if you're curious to know what we can learn from some of the leaders in the industry, then you might find several pockets of the podcast of value. Thank you for spending your time on the podcast. To know more about the work I do, you could visit transitioninsight.com. Signing off, this is your host, Deepak Jayaraman. Bye now.